And in the summer of 2018, as protests against the Trump administration immigration policies intensified and the movement to abolish ICE gained momentum, the federal agency at the center of the storm was keeping tabs on a series of anti-Trump protests in New York City. According to documents obtained by The Nation via Freedom of Information Act request, among the protests the agency tracked were several promoting immigrants' rights and opposing the administration's deportation policies, as well as one protesting the National Rifle Association. One event was organized by a sitting member of Congress. Lee Rowland is policy director of the New York Civil Liberties Union and an expert on civil rights.
The Nation has uncovered a document showing that ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, has kept at least one spreadsheet tracking anti-Trump protests in New York City. And to be clear, that's not my language. The language of anti-Trump protests comes directly from this ICE document. And that's really significant. This is not suggested that it is a public safety risk, that there was any concern about unlawful activity or even immigration-related activity. The protests included on this list were 100% protected speech by members of the public speaking about matters of policy, and specifically matters of policy where they oppose the Trump regime. And in particular, when we're talking about immigration activists, they have every right to speak out publicly about the abject cruelty of the Trump administration's deportation machine and its treatment of immigrants here throughout the country. So this spreadsheet is unbelievably troubling because it demonstrates that our immigration authorities have not only gone outside of their authority to deal with immigration enforcement, they have not only gone outside of their mandate as law enforcement to protect public safety, but they are monitoring completely protected, they are monitoring constitutionally protected activity, speech and protest that is at the very core of our Constitution protections. So not only is this not a matter of public safety, it is an example of law enforcement monitoring and, I think, very troublingly investigating people for their constitutionally protected speech.
What happens next? Is there going to be any sort of legal action? Because it seems like a lot of, I've talked to Ravi Ragbear, I talked to some folks from Rise and Resist, and they say, and I'm from my own experience as a reporter, they were obviously following me, I know that, I could tell you about that later. Where do we go now from that?
Well, actually, there already are legal actions on this issue that I think suggest that this kind of enforcement is on constitutionally very thin ice. Just a few months ago, the Supreme Court issued a ruling saying that law enforcement may not retaliate against someone and use their protected speech or belief as the main reason for arrest. The Supreme Court actually overturned the arrest of someone who, by the way, did break the law, and where the cops had claimed some degree of probable cause simply because the cops targeted him without question because of his protected speech. He was kind of a gadfly and had annoyed the police officers, and they decided to basically make an example out of him. The Supreme Court rightly said, our First Amendment prevents you from doing law enforcement that way. Law enforcement is about public safety, and in order for our constitutional promise of free speech to be respected, if it means anything, it means that cops can't decide who they arrest and who they don't based on that person's speech or beliefs. So we now have a very strong case at the Supreme Court that's recent that gives pretty clear direction to police that targeting someone's beliefs and opinions is not a proper method of law enforcement, period, full stop. In addition, the Second Circuit Federal Court, which is the federal court that governs New York, in addition to other states, is taking up an appeal by Ravi Ragbir, who you mentioned, who is an anti-ICE activist, someone who has opposed the Trump regime's cruel deportation regime, and has been singled out for deportation hearings, for deportation, because of his outspoken activism. Ravi's attorneys have filed an appeal at the Second Circuit that the court heard at the end of 2018, and we're still waiting for an opinion there. The NYCLU and other groups filed briefs, friend of the court briefs, with the court, arguing that that kind of policing that is targeting someone for arrest or deportation solely because of their speech violates the First Amendment. And especially with this Supreme Court case in the background, I'm confident and hopeful that Mr. Rogbeer will prevail. So, of course, all we have here, just to be clear, that the nation has uncovered is a spreadsheet. And nowhere on the spreadsheet has anyone put something in writing. No one at least has been so foolish that I've seen that says, because of this protest, we're going to arrest this person. But it also is impossible to look at this spreadsheet in a vacuum. We have several years now of evidence of ICE targeting immigration advocates, including in the city of New York, including Ravi Rogbeer. So I think this is powerful evidence for those who attended these rallies that they have gotten onto ICE's radar, not because they present any public safety risk, not because they are part of normal day-to-day immigration enforcement, but precisely because of that protected behavior. So I think ICE is really in hot water here, because there are a number of people who can now point to this and say, this is why I was picked up, not for any legitimate law enforcement or immigration enforcement reason.
Lee Rowland is policy director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. On February 14, 2018, immigrant rights advocates with the New Sanctuary Coalition held an Ash Wednesday demonstration outside the ICE offices at 26 Federal Plaza in Manhattan. The protesters plan to offer ashes, as per Christian tradition, to all who pass by as a symbol of solidarity with immigrants facing deportation. An email exchange between the deputy field director of ICE's New York field office and the assistant field office director, whose names have been redacted, shows that the officials were well aware of the planned demonstration. The Ash Wednesday protest, quote, saves us the trip of going over to the church, wrote the assistant field director, field office director, in a February 14th email. He said, I certainly hope they, the immigrant rights activists, won't discriminate against ICE officers. I'll pass, the deputy director responded, implying that he would not accept ashes from the religiously minded protesters. Several months later, in a July 24th, 2018 email, the deputy field office director of ICE's New York field office, whose name has been redacted, sent an email to a number of top local ICE officials and what appear to be multiple ICE listservs, including one titled hashtag IceWatch event notification, in order to provide agency personnel with information about an upcoming protest in front of ICE's office in Manhattan. The protest, dubbed the Deportee Suitcase Solidarity March, was organized by the New Solidarity Coalition. Ravi Rogbeer is director of the organization, and he spoke with WBAI earlier today.
We have a program, where an accompaniment program, where we partner U.S. citizens with non-citizens who have to interact with immigration enforcement. Immediately after the training, every single aspect of our training, they countered the role of our volunteers, our citizen volunteers. So we suspected that, and this is confirmation of that suspect. It is very distressing, though, to know that the agency is surveilling us and surveilling all organizations like this. But what is even more distressing is that the spreadsheet didn't say anti-ICE protest. It says anti-Trump protest. So that is very disconcerting to know that who is this agency report to? Are they for the America, or is it for the president?
Do you think that they actually had infiltrators in your training sessions?
We believe they had infiltrators at the training. We also believe that they have had infiltrators at our protests and our rallies and vigils. They speak about having someone, especially at our suitcase rally, they were part of. We believe, and these documents, it does not explicitly show that there's infiltrators, but it definitely points in that direction.
What was the purpose of the suitcase rally that was surveilled?
Most people, unfortunately not all, when they are getting deported, their loved one is allowed to prepare a suitcase that is 25 pounds in weight that the person can take with them when they're deported to the country. So the suitcase rally was, what would you pack for your loved one? Only 25 pounds. Obviously, you can't pack much. So what was it that was so important that you will want to send with your loved one when they're exiled? There was a huge emotional connection. We believe that they were walking around in and around the protest.
what effect on your movement, on your organization, does this knowledge, when it comes out, that you're being...
Yes, this would normally be a chilling effect because it goes back to the McCarthyism, right, where you are being checked and surveilled in a COINTELPRO. You are being checked by this agency. It should have a chilling effect because you, even though this president is talking about writing an executive order to protect free speech in college for conservatives, yet he wants to clamp down on free speech from other citizens who disagree with him. So there's a hypocrisy of this president. Why is it that ICE is doing the administration's dirty work? This is an agency that is supposed to be focused on non-citizens. The jurisdiction is non-citizens, but yet they are surveilling non-citizens. And this goes back to the fact that this agency is a plenary agency, which means that they have very little oversight by Congress and by the courts. And so they can do a lot of dirty work without being punished, without facing the recriminations. We need to be concerned when there's an agency like this, especially with this administration who is focused on ethnic cleansing.
Ravi Raghbir is director of the New Sanctuary Coalition. The July 24th ICE email, which was sent to the deputy field office director and labeled confidential and high importance, contained detailed information gleaned from the deportee Suitcase Solidarity March's Facebook page. This information included the number of people who had signed up on Facebook to attend the event, a description of the event, and the name of the sponsors, like the Legal Aid Society and the New Sanctuary Coalition. And here in the United States, the government kept a database on journalists, activists, organizers, and instigators, in their words, during an investigation into last year's migrant caravan, infuriating civil liberties and media groups who called it a blatant violation of free speech rights. U.S. Customs and Border Protection compiled information on dozens of people that included passport and social media photos, dates of birth, personal information, and their suspected role in the caravans that were coming from Central America to the U.S. border. Some of the people on the list were denied entry into Mexico and had their passports flagged or visas revoked. The database was revealed Wednesday by the San Diego TV station, KNSD. People listed in the documents provided to the station included 10 journalists, many of whom are U.S. citizens, and an American attorney. There were several dozen people in all on the list, including many labeled as instigators. And on Wednesday, The Nation reported that immigration rights activists in New York City had been surveilled by immigration police and a previously little-known agency called Homeland Security Investigations. The Nation released internal emails gotten through the Freedom of Information Act that showed officials had kept close tabs on activists, including a sitting congressional representative. And the National Security Agency spying program to analyze logs of the domestic calls and texts of U.S. citizens is reportedly no longer in use, and the legislation which made it legal may not be renewed when it expires at the end of the year. The NSA's mass monitoring of logs of phone calls and texts related to U.S. citizens first began in 2006, some 5 years after the 9/11 attacks. The program was revealed by Edward Snowden in 2013 and was later declared illegal by a federal appeals court. The senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation is Andrew Crocker. He says while news that the NSA will not ask for extension of the program is good, little is known about what might replace it.
The law that they use to do this data collection, Section 215 of the Patriot Act, expires at the end of this year. And what the staffer said was they're not going to push for it to be reauthorized. The program was famously revealed by Edward Snowden and written about in The Guardian in 2013 that the NSA was collecting in bulk telephone records on a daily basis of most or all phone calls made inside the United States and going out of the United States. That was reined in somewhat in 2015 by Congress, but what we've learned in the last year or so is that they're still collecting millions and millions of telephone records, 530 million in 2017 alone.
And these are from Americans?
Yes.
So how do they collect this? Remind us how it's done.
Prior to the passage of that law in 2015, the way it was done was the NSA would go to the FISA court and get orders to telephone companies to turn over these records on a daily basis. So an order to Verizon is actually Verizon, a subsidiary of Verizon, is what Snowden first revealed to The Guardian, was published in 2013. After the passage of this law in 2015, they changed the program a little bit, and now those orders are issued to the telephone companies, and they don't turn over the records preemptively. They're just turning over records using seed numbers, a about which the, you know, the NSA is using as a target, and they get all of the numbers that that target has called, and then all of the numbers that the target's contacts have called. So they call that two hops out. And as I said, that's resulted in, even so, the collection of, you know, hundreds of millions of records a year.
Second, what is that? The second degree of connection is equal to millions and millions of people. Amazing.
Yeah.
And where does this information go? Where do they store it? And then what do they do with it?
We don't know everything they do with it. We know that it goes into a centralized database and that they run queries on these databases when they're beginning investigations. And that's sort of what allows them to go deeper. If they have suspicion about this one number, as I mentioned, and they have everyone's contacts and the contacts in the database, if they come up in response to search, they can then open a sort of a fuller investigation and look into other databases where they might have so-called incidentally collected those people's actual communications, that instead of just the records of their calls, the actual content of emails and conversations. So it's sort of the starting point for deeper investigations, usually, we think.
What will happen next, do you think?
It's really a quickly evolving thing. As you already mentioned, the New York Times report about this staffer saying that it's been stopped is surprising. I think that it's very likely that either the NSA will say they still need this provision, even if they're not using it currently, or in reality, they're doing something else that substitutes for this program and that they're perfectly happy to let it expire because they're, you know, they've got a similar capability somewhere else in the law. So one of the things that we're really focusing on, asking the public and certainly asking Congress to do, is to get more information about this so that we can be satisfied that they're following the laws that do exist and that they're not going beyond those bounds of that, which is where these hundreds of millions of records come from.
Is the Fourth Amendment dead for all practical purposes? Should it be just like ripped out of the Constitution, or do we have a chance of getting back some of the freedoms we used to have?
I don't think the Fourth Amendment is dead by any stretch. The Supreme Court's recent case law has made very clear that they're going to be protective of privacy and of the Fourth Amendment against the encroachment of technology. So even as we all become more reliant on technology, and it, you know, is very convenient in many respects, it does come with these risks of collection of data by third parties, and of course that being available to the government. And at least on the Fourth Amendment side, on the government side, the Supreme Court has made very clear that we can't just revert to the way things were before, and we can't just say, oh, if you pass it over to third parties, you're screwed, you don't have any privacy. They've said, no, you can still have privacy in records held by these companies. And I think that's a very good thing, and it's really the direction the court is taking. So I actually have real faith in the viability of the Fourth Amendment going forward.
And that was Andrew Crocker, Senior Staff Attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.